Hello and welcome to the ARO Global Q3 2025 results. My name is Sergey and I'll be your coordinator for today's event. Please note this call is being recorded and for the duration of the call your lines will be on a listen-only mode. However, you will have the opportunity to ask questions at the end of the call. This can be done by pressing star one on your telephone keypad to register your question. If you require assistance at any point, please press star zero and you will be connected to an operator. On the call today we have Zach Lewis, Group Chief Executive Officer and Group Chief Investment Officer, and Phil Shepard, Group Chief Financial Officer. I will now hand you over to your host, Zach Lewis, to begin today's conference. Over to you, Mr. Lewis. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergey. It's a great pleasure to give you the results for the first 9 months of 2025. As you know, we run a strong, vertically integrated Western European fund manager and asset management business. We made substantial progress this quarter. I'll go through the key milestones in a moment, but I guess just generally, according to kind of franchise progress, I think having incorporated strong benefit from Germany and France and Spain into the business over the last 2 years, having, as you've seen in the presentation, successfully delivered now multi-billion-dollar-plus products into the market in different categories, the core franchise has progressed strongly and feels like a very solid foundation around Western Europe being our geographic footprint, multi-product asset-backed strategies being our core activity, and having great progress across investors wanting to partner with us and our 25 platforms, and now the 8 countries where we can deliver value to them. It's a rare thing to have the capacity to be local in 8 countries simultaneously off one fund manager commitment, and we're able to use that to deliver them now multiple products as a leading player. If you look at the core franchise that delivers that, we now service $125 billion of third-party assets on our platforms. That's our servicing AUM. As you see, the funds under management has grown to $13.6 billion, which obviously use those platforms for sourcing, underwriting, and servicing. That's led to a strong growth in FRE, so the $75.4 million that you see, all of that is recurring. None of that is performance fees yet. That good deployment across now ARO Credit Opportunities as well as ARO Lending Opportunities, and to a lesser extent ARO Real Estate Opportunities, has led to a significant increase in deployment because we're now deploying out of multiple funds simultaneously, leading to the $2.7 billion of deployment over the last 12 months. We've also had strong realizations. Phil walked through that in more detail, which, given we've got such a strong growing profile, you'd expect realizations to trail in value slightly the deployments, but we realized $1.3 billion, and we'll give you further details on where that arose and the distributions, etc., in coming pages. Moving to page 4, it's obviously a great pleasure today to announce we obviously had the first close of ACO3. That's enabled us to increase our assets in the opportunistic credit strategy by $2.7 billion. We also had the final close of ARO Lending Opportunities, which grew the size of that fund complex to $1.5 billion, all numbers euros. There's been very few billion-euro-plus fund ones in Europe, and obviously we've now achieved that feat twice across different products, which is great. Pleasingly, on two other franchise notes, we've been able to get more than 50% of our clients now to take more than one product. I think that's particularly notable given we didn't do any LP-oriented products until January of 2020, and therefore having only rolled out 3 funds of size in that period to have our investors back us, given that forward role of a growing client base where more than half of them have now taken 2 or more products, is great progress. Also, we have made, I think, substantial progress penetrating the deep and recurring North American market. You'll remember in ACO2, North America was just under 20% of capital commitments. Now we've got to a point where North America makes up 38% of our investor base, and that's good progress into the world's biggest market for alts. I guess we had always carried a significant number of European relationships, given we service a lot of structured credit and other areas where European investors got the chance to know us. The fact that we've been able to obviously expand in the Middle East, expand in North America, and we had 10% of our capital previously from Asia, that remains roughly the same. And so it's been a nice growth, leading to a strong growth of total capital under management. The other major announcement we had today was that we've completed the agreement to sell Zenith. Zenith has been a great performer for the group. We bought it in 2017. We've expanded it significantly. We bought it, obviously, for you can go back and check it out, but circa €23 million back in 2017. And so being able to sell it today, having recouped dividends substantially along the way for $110 million gross, we were really pleased with that. The buyer was not a competitor of ours. It was from an adjacent industry, and they will make their full announcement next week and give you further details on the sale. We felt that was a productive return of capital to the holdco, increasing our firepower in the holdco. From a franchise perspective, Zenith was very important in our early understanding of the Italian market. As a master servicer, they've got a great purview over the activities in Italy. And so it was helpful to own that business and to understand the Italian market from the position of the trustee and seeing how the market functioned, how servicers performed, et cetera. I think as we've now gotten bigger and recognizing we also inherited the Sistemia franchise inside Akira, we felt that our Italian franchise was in very strong shape with Europa Investimenti, Sagita, Sansidoni, and Sistemia, which we all own, giving us a very, very strong Italian footprint. But to ensure that we keep the franchise benefits of Zenith for our purposes, given the buyer wasn't a competitor, we were able to extend the sourcing agreement we've historically had with Zenith for the next 5 years, including all the servicing agreements as such, and we would intend to use Zenith in exactly that fashion. As you may know, that our platforms sign a sourcing and servicing agreement with our funds, and so it was very easy to just leave the terms of those agreements unchanged for the next 5 years. Given the buyer wasn't a competitor of ours, they wanted our volume and didn't compete with the investment motivations of that. So even though Zenith is a direct feedstock to the funds, is relatively small, any such deals that come out of that are still preserved for the benefit of our fund investors for the next 5 years. Moving to page five, just chatting through the core fund manager franchise. So deployment was significantly up on trailing 12 months. 51% up year-on-year. We had a very strong first half of 2025. Q3 was a little slower, as I think we obviously, given it's July, August, and September in Europe, it's always a bit slower. And I think we were consolidating after a heavy level of investment in the 12 months prior through to June. We've seen the typical pickup as you know, Q4 has historically been our most active quarter, and we've seen a substantial pickup in Q4 versus Q3. But all of that has led us to being broadly on line with our medium-term goal run rate. As you saw last time, we were trailing at the target of $3 billion capital deployment per year. A lot of that growth that you see at the top right, page five, is the pull-through of our lending opportunities now operating aligned with our credit opportunities, and both of them deploying into their respective target markets simultaneously. And so, yeah, we're pleased with how that has built out. We've also, as our platforms continue to mature, and our leaders in their local areas have found a number of targeted areas where repeat deal flow has given us really strong thematic leadership and scale. We call out hospitality as an example there, and purpose-built student housing, both of which are going through a strong period in hospitality in Southern Europe and purpose-built student housing in the UK. And so, yeah, those areas have performed well now across multiple different parts of the capital structure, given Arrow lending opportunities, just first lien mortgages against such assets, and Arrow Credit Opportunities buys those kind of assets when opportunities arise, the distress side being more anchored in Southern Europe and the lending side being more anchored in Northern Europe. In terms of the funds at the bottom of page 5, I just want to clarify, in case it hasn't previously been as clear, just how these funds exactly work. So you deploy the capital the first 3 years from the final close is the investment period. So take ACO1, the investment period ran from effectively November of 2020 to November of 2023. During that period, you recycle all capital. That is the format of the fund. And after that period, you distribute capital. The capital flow is not a it's technically discretionary, but the practical expectation, the practical side of it is that for assets that realize in the first 3 years after the final close of the fund, you're expected to recycle those to boost money multiples with efficiency of recycling. And after year three, as you realize the assets in the fund, you distribute the net proceeds out to investors. So when you talk about DPI for the funds, DPI is expected to be zero effectively until the end of the investment period, and then is expected to progress from there. So as you look at ACO1, the investment period ended in November of 2023, and so we're basically at the not even at the end of the quarter, at the two-year anniversary of the end of the investment period. And we've already distributed €500 million back to investors. To put that in perspective, you'll remember the $1.7 billion that we raised was a mixture of third-party money, Arrow, and co-invest. Most of that co-invest was never drawn, so that $500 million of distributions, order of magnitude to ACO1 investors, is broadly just under half of what they invested with us, and we've obviously done that in under 2 years, which is a very strong DPI ratio compared to pretty much any other credit fund. If you look at ACO2, the same process, except for in ACO2, we clarified that the $2.75 billion was all SMAs and main fund commitments, i.e. none of it was co-invest in that $2.75 billion. All of it was drawable. Which is what's happened. So we use that $2.75 billion. We've had realizations in that fund of over $1 billion already. We've recycled those as expected and drawn a significant portion of the $2.75 billion. We're not quite at 100%, but have drawn a significant portion of that. And that's enabled a very efficient recycling, so that the combination of drawn capital and the more than $1 billion of realizations taken together has enabled us to invest $3.9 billion, the delta being a small subline that we use. And the performance against that's been fantastic. We did, because we had some very strong realizations, we collected over $300 million in the fund in one quarter last year. We did distribute $100 million, even though it was during the investment period, just because we had surplus cash on hand. But we don't hold investor cash. We hold when it's there, surplus, we distribute it. Otherwise, it's invested in credit assets. The trigger for ACO3 is when you have basically committed to investment 70% of the fund. There's then some practicalities around you're obviously drawing it subsequently because of the subline, but once you've actually committed about 70% of the money, you start the ACO3 fundraising exercise. In this case, that was in April of 25. And so it's obviously a great progress that from April of 25 through to, the announcement today, we've raised $2.7 billion in ACO3. That's come from a very strong re-up of existing investors combined with some nice new gains out of various markets, including North America. And that's enabled us to, raise $2.7 billion in basically, circa 6 months. We obviously will keep going with that product. We expect to see very strong growth in ACO3 versus ACO2. And given the strong growth in deployment, the size of the fund does need to be bigger to correlate with the size of the franchise, which now benefits from having France, Germany, and Spain alongside our original five countries. As I move to page six, basically, you'll see that our medium targets remain unchanged, but we've made major, major progress to get to these targets. So I think when we announced the $15 billion target, we were at just about or sub $10 billion of AUM. We're now at 13.6, well on our way to $15 billion. We will largely get there just completing out ACO3. And so we feel extremely good about that $15 billion target. When we come back around to the market with Arrow Lending Opportunities 2, which Arrow Lending Opportunities is already about half deployed. So we will likely come back to that market later in 26, early 27, order of magnitude. We will strongly surpass that $15 billion target. So just the passage of execution over the next 12 to 18 months will have us achieve and beat that medium-term funds under management target. On the deployment side, that $3 billion run rate, we're basically there now. We were there in the trailing 12 months to June. We've been largely at that level. We're a bit below it after the slow summer period, but with the fourth quarter in, we'll be, orders of magnitude in that range. As we play off the larger Germany, France, Spain footprint, and with our lending opportunities and credit opportunities at a bigger size, both contributing, we feel very good about being in the right place for that $3 billion target on deployment. Discretionary fund NAV builds progressively. Obviously, the origination number is the key effectively input feedstock to that discretionary fund NAV. That has grown nicely, and the $6 billion is the target we have there. The 40% return on assets is the consequence of us lowering, in effect, the participation percentage. The participation percentage in ACO1 was Arrow put up 25%. In ACO2, Arrow put up 10%. In Arrow Lending, Arrow put up circa 6%. And in Arrow Credit Opportunities 3, Arrow puts up circa 6%. So our portion of the funds has been coming down in line with the funds getting larger, and obviously thereby the third-party portion of the capital going up, which means far more of the capital we deploy is fee-generating, and therefore the returns on equity keep going up for every dollar of capital deployed. And so, that 40% return target, which is driven by management fee and in due course carry, plus our servicing fee, plus the actual underlying asset return, is growing strongly. I think if you track out how the fund manager profitability has grown from 2021 to 2025, I think it's grown 430% over that time. So the core profitability of that model is spectacular. We just need to continue to keep growing in the metronomic way of raising the capital, investing the capital, and then collecting the capital back to deliver for our investors. But from the GP or fund manager's perspective, the pull-through of that franchise is such that as you see capital get deployed and the NAV build, the rest, like most fee-related earnings activities, is predictable. That will, over time, delever us. As the funds that required more substantial co-invest from us, the 25-10-6, as that comes down, the portion of our own capital that goes back out obviously decreases. And as the fee-related earnings replace the legacy back book, which is now obviously assets we've acquired prior to 2020, basically we obviously recur it in we achieve those EBITDA denominators in a recurring way that doesn't require capital to replenish. The balance sheet's been relatively stable as the size of our deployment's been high, and so even off the lower percentage, we've been able to keep the balance sheet roughly stable. So, and Phil will walk through that when he goes through the balance sheet segment. But look, we've made very substantial progress against our targets. Obviously, progress in these kind of businesses isn't linear. You have milestone moments, and it was really a positive and pleasure to be able to come on the call today and say, look, ACO 3, we've had that first close. ALO, we've gotten to $1.5 billion, which, given we started with a billion target, is very strong. We also won Alternative Credit Investor, Distressed Debt Manager of the Year and Real Estate Debt Manager of the Year. So, the progress we've made across the franchise to lead in those two categories is very strong, and I think that's reflected itself with investor demand and the progress we've made in raising, deploying, and then realizing and delivering back to our investors on our funds. With that, I'll pass to Phil to go through the financials.
Thanks, Zach. Good afternoon, everyone. I'll start with the results of the integrated fund management segment shown on slide 8, which includes the capital-light earnings from both our discretionary fund management and our third-party asset management activities. Total fee-related earnings grew 12% year-on-year to $58.3 million, with strong revenue growth at consistent margins. Overall, revenues grew by 14% to $250.9 million, which comprises a 59% rise in the discretionary fund management revenues to $118.7 million, and a 9% fall in the third-party asset management revenues to $132.2 million. You may recall that we reported a similar decrease in third-party asset management revenue at the half year. The decrease is driven by the switch in business from third-party clients to our discretionary funds with the launch of Arrow Lending Opportunities in the second half of last year. In particular, a significant portion of revenues within Maslow are now classified within the discretionary fund management business rather than third-party asset management. Third-party asset management revenues over the nine-month period have grown by 28% since the comparable period in 2023, in line with the guidance of revenue growth at mid to high single-digit percentage per annum through the cycle. Slide 9 has further analysis on the performance of our discretionary fund management business, which includes the fees generated from both fund management and asset management and servicing activities provided to our discretionary funds, Arrow Credit Opportunities, Arrow Real Estate Opportunities, and Arrow Lending Opportunities. The group primarily generates returns from deployed capital, with deployment of capital driving the growth in fee-earning NAV, which in turn drives the revenues. And the charts on slide 9 show the strong progression of deployment driving earnings growth. Deployment was a record in the 9 months to September 2025, up 0.7 billion on the prior year to 1.9 billion euros, with the commencement of deployment into Arrow Lending Opportunities in the period. This has in turn driven the growth in fee earning NAV of 44% from 3.2 billion at the end of Q3 2024 to 4.6 billion at the end of September 2025, with average NAV of 3.4 billion sterling. This growth in the fee earning NAV has delivered an increase in the discretionary fund management fee related revenues of 59% or 44 million to 118.7 million. It is clear to see the correlation between the NAV growth of 44% year on year and revenue growth up 59% year-on-year. And based upon a 10% co-investment level, the group targets capital-light returns of 30% on the capital invested by Arrow, broadly split 10% from fund management activities, 10% from asset management and servicing, and 10% from performance fees or carried interest. And to date, we have not recognised any performance fees or carried interest. Slide 10 demonstrates the inherent earnings growth potential of the business. I provided similar guidance on prior earnings calls, and slides 22 and 23 in the appendix provide further explanation. But essentially, if we continue to deploy capital at $3 billion per annum, consistent with the current investment and realisation profiles, then the NAV will grow to around $8 billion from the current $4.6 billion. And as I've explained, NAV drives the revenues, and our target margins, our integrated fund management business would be generating EBITDA of $161 million compared with the current Q3 year-to-date of $83 million, with additional annualised revenues from carry of circa $69 million per annum. Switching back to the actual integrated fund management results, and slide 11 summarises the results split between the discretionary fund management and third-party asset management activities. EBITDA derived from our discretionary fund management is a function of the average fee earning NAV of 3.4 billion sterling at the 30% margin on Arrow's co-investments, and since we are not yet recognising any carry or performance fees, then the implied EBITDA for the nine-month period is circa 50 million. The third-party asset management activity, typically at a 15% EBITDA margin, and therefore the implied EBITDA is circa 20 million based upon the revenues of 132 million. The ongoing investment drag of circa 11 million during the period reflects the continued costs of scaling operations, with certain activities not yet fully at the required operational leverage, and also the impact of timing of certain fees in connection with Arrow lending opportunities, which are more back-end loaded. These three component parts combine to the overall reported integrated fund management EBITDA of 58 million. Turning now to the results of the balance sheet segment shown on slide 12. This segment reflects the investment returns of the back book investments alongside the returns generated on our co-investments in our discretionary funds. EBITDA for the period was 43.8 million, some 2.5 million lower than prior year, predominantly due to the one-off Concordato income on certain Italian portfolios arising in Q1 2024, not repeated in 2025, that I've spoken about on prior earnings calls. The realisations performance was 181.4 million, representing 102% of expectations, with full year realisation expectations of circa 266 million, consistent with the position reported previously, and includes realisations in the last quarter of 85 million. It should be noted that the realisations profile of secured investment portfolios are lumpy in nature, as the realisation is typically driven by the sale of the underlying real estate. And based upon the current expected realisations profile, as shown on slide 25 in the appendix, full year realisations in 2026 are expected to be circa 70 million higher than the full year 2025. The carrying value of the balance sheet investments increased by 112 million during the 9 months to 818 million, and driven by the record deployment. Our co-investment levels continue to reduce, with typical co-investment in ACO1 at 25%, reduced to 10% in ACO2, and reduced further to 7% in Arrow lending opportunities, and will reduce to 6% in ACO3. This level of co-investment will drive a lower level of the carrying value of balance sheet investments in due course. Slide 13 shows the overall result together with the group segmental performance. Group costs primarily relate to the centrally controlled overhead costs and were 30.4 million for the nine-month period. Costs are running at a broadly consistent run rate of 10 million per quarter, with second half costs in 2024 of 19 million and first half costs in 2025 at 20 million. The group costs are higher than prior year by 5.8 million, reflecting the scaling of the business in H1 2024, with the establishment of our lending fund, the expansion into new jurisdictions, and as such, there has been a build in the talent and capabilities leading to the growth of group costs to be consistent with the run rate seen over the past 12 months. This has enabled the record deployment and build of capitalized earnings, and the current level of group segmental cost is reflective of a business scaled to deliver deployment volumes of circa 3 billion per annum without any need for significant cost increase. The full underlying income statement is also shown on this slide, and overall, the loss before tax, adjusting items, and non-cash foreign exchange has widened by 20.3 million to 35 million. Along with the segmental results that I've just discussed, the result has been impacted by the increased financing costs, primarily due to the refinancing completed in late 2024. Finance costs have risen by 16.1 million to 96.3 million for the nine-month period. In addition, and as reported in prior periods, as the group grows its euro income, predominantly due to the growth in management fees and in due course carried interest in our funds, the group is maintaining a net euro liability position. The retranslation of this liability position gives rise to some non-cash P&L volatility and was a 46.6 million loss in 2025 against a gain of 7.7 million reported in Q3 2024, with a year-on-year variance of 54.3 million. I'd emphasize that maintaining a net euro liability position provides an economic hedge against the group's exposure to euro FX movements, given the future euro income growth, but does lead to some near-term non-cash P&L volatility. The detailed breakdown of the free cash flow generation is shown on slide 14. The group's free cash flow was 69 million. The 174.9 million outflow on portfolio investments reflects the record deployment in the nine-month period. Free cash flow generation after portfolio investment was an outflow of 106 million, which compares with the uplift in the carrying value of the balance sheet investments of 112 million. Typical co-investment levels are reducing, as I noted before, 7% for ALO from 10% in ACO2, and the co-investment within ACO3 will be 6%. As such, I expect future funds to be at around this level, which will lead to the reduction of the euro equivalent level of our co-investment. As we scale volumes, that level of co-investment will not increase at the same pace. As our integrated fund management fee-related earnings continue to build alongside this proportionately reduced co-investment requirements, the free cash flow generation will continue to deliver sustainable deleveraging of the balance sheet. Slide 15 shows our leverage and funding position. The group's liquidity position and funding base are strong, with maturities pushed out to 2029 following the refinancing completed in Q4 2024. The position has been further strengthened with the execution of a bond tap in June 2025, raising an additional 150 million euros, with liquidity headroom growing to 350 million sterling as at September 2025. During November, the remaining stub of fixed-rate bonds due in 2026 and totaling 71 million became repayable at par. As such, the group repaid the bonds using available liquidity headroom. Leverage was 5.8x after incorporating the reduction in net debt once the sale of the non-core platform Zenith completes. As I guided to previously, leverage was expected to rise given the significant Q3 2024 realizations. The realization profiles of secured investment portfolios are lumpy in nature, as the realization is typically driven by the sale of the underlying real estate. And as I noted earlier, full-year realizations in 2026 are expected to be circa $70 million higher than full-year 2025, which will lead to a reduction in leverage. There are also two additional factors to note. Net debt has increased firstly due to the record deployment, with the carrying value of balance sheet investments rising by $112 million, which impacts leverage by 0.5 times. And secondly, the movement in the euro FX rate has led to a $61 million increase on the retranslation of our euro debt to sterling, which has impacted leverage by 0.3 times. The realization profile going into 2026 and the capital-light business model will enable us to deliver sustainable deleveraging. It is also important to highlight the leverage calculation uses adjusted EBITDA in the denomination of the calculation. Therefore, equal weighting is given to £1 worth of discretionary fee-related earnings as it is to £1 worth of realizations, which clearly requires an upfront investment of circa 60 pence to generate. Our capital-light model leaves us well-placed to continue to expand our integrated fund management proposition across credit, real estate and lending, in turn further driving fee-related earnings growth without placing strain on our balance sheets and facilitating sustainable deleveraging towards the strategic leverage commitment of 3 times. Thank you, and I'll now hand back to Zach.
Thank you, Phil. Moving to page 17, as we look to the outlook and look forward, we point out a few things in closing. I mean, one is that our business stands to benefit more from the current AI revolution than most. I mean, obviously, you know, with a very large servicing footprint and more than, you know, several thousand employees, we have the opportunity to gain AI efficiencies in a number of servicing areas. We've started a whole range of work streams, and frankly, a lot of the tools that are now available generally are of relevant interest. We spent a bunch of time building as many financial institutions have, a internally safe area where obviously we've got a lockdown area for customer data, et cetera, so that basically we can operate with some of those tools without risk of data leakage. And so that progress really setting the foundation for gains we can make due to AI is something we're excited about. We'd expect those gains to occur in 4 categories. One in sourcing, where we already use AI, for example, to scan Italian claims, which tend to have hundreds, in some cases, thousands of documents. And so using the AI to scan those and deliver back to us a scorecard where we can prioritize the claims we want to look at that meet our criteria has saved us a ton of time and actually allowed us to look at more than 10,000 claims in that market, which had we done that manually, it would have taken, I mean, literally hundreds of lawyers for years to do it. And the AI can do it basically immediately. It's obviously an incredible efficiency gain. And there's some other areas where we think that same scorecarding approach that we're currently using are applicable. On underwriting, I'd love to get to a place, we're not there yet, but I'd love to get to a place where, given, again, we've got a substantial database and a repeated investment approach, I'd love to get to a place where, whilst obviously the investment committees will make decisions on different investments, I'd like to get to a place where we can feed the relevant information into an AI tool that can highlight, you know, its outlook and its view of risks and returns and areas of focus on each individual investment. Obviously, that's more an underwriting support tool, but I think having that kind of a tool going forward is important and will allow us to learn and better the decisioning process. I think on the servicing side, it obviously jumps out that, you know, given we do a very substantial amount of repeated process activity, and we've got the databases that support that going back many, many years, we have the training data set, and I think a lot of the systems tools that frankly are being built for the market generally would benefit us. And so we spent a bunch of time evaluating those, and in due course expect to make efficiencies there. And then the final category is ops efficiency, which is more of a central functions kind of opportunity that in reality in a firm like ours where you've got substantial amounts of work on everything from treasury to investor reporting to servicing reporting, the AI tools that reduce the cost of customization of those reports to a level where we can meet client requirements in a repeatable, templated way is something that we'd expect to achieve over time using the AI to better that effort. We've spent a lot of time internally refining our taxonomies to make sure that we've got consistency across all the different data sets. That sounds easy, but, you know, with 25 platforms in 8 countries, that's a big operational lift. And again, using the AI incrementally to basically identify ways to do that reporting where investors get what they want, but we can pull the data off the correct taxonomy internally and give accurate responses is something, again, I'm optimistic that the AI can help us better. And so I think each of those areas are kind of fairly short-term quick wins without a lot of CapEx, given the AI tools are now generally available in ways that as we've secured the internal kind of Arrow footprint from a data architecture point of view and from a systems setup point of view, you know, we can make, I think, relatively rapid progress in various areas there that will improve our business without much CapEx. I think as we move, therefore, to kind of looking again at the wider franchise, closing on page 18, you know, we really feel good that, I mean, we're the market leader by a distance in asset-backed Western Europe middle market exposures. The fact that investors can come to us, get access to 25 platforms in 8 countries worth of deal flow from a single relationship, in that middle market size is important. I think in Europe, where 95% of investments are domestic, you know, it's Germans to Germans, French to French, Italians to Italians, being local is fundamental, and operating that model gives us a huge competitive advantage and is very difficult to replicate. And obviously, you've seen from the strong support we've had from investors, they've, you know, done the work, seen our results, gone through all the detail and realized that onboarding us is a far more superior solution for them versus getting, you know, a bit of Europe in a broader global multi-strat, or the opposite, trying to onboard, you know, tens of partners themselves so they can go after the same local asset types. And so by having one relationship with us, they get access to that local franchise. And so we've, as you know, focused very hard on optimizing that franchise in a way that delivers benefit to the investors. And as you've seen from Phil's data, you know, progressively delivers benefit to us as that fee-related earnings replace our historical balance sheet in a way that grows very high ROE capital light income. And with that, Sergey, I'll pass over to questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question at this time, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. And please make sure the mute function on your phone line is switched off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, please press star 1 to ask a question. We will pause for just a moment to allow it to signal. We will now take our first question from Carl Strecker from Guggenheim. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. Bill, in terms of the fee drag, can you just talk a little bit more about that? Because it does seem like the growth in fee-related earnings particularly is, you know, is when we look at the kind of the sub-segments, it's being impacted by growth and that implied investment cost drag. So you alluded to certain functions that need to scale, and then also the impact of fees in ALO. But could you talk about the functions that need to scale, and also how much is between those two categories for the investment drag?
Yeah, sure. The investment drag has been sort of 11 million for the nine-month period, and as I sort of said, there's those two primary reasons. One is the scaling of those operations, and then also the profile of some of the lending fees. So just taking those in turn, there's various areas where we are building out capabilities, and so that's not yet at scale. So there is a number of areas. So we've obviously acquired Maslow in the U.K., which has been very strong in terms of origination of lending volumes. We are replicating and building out lending capabilities in some of the other jurisdictions as well. That's more advanced given our sort of maturity of platforms. But that's one example. We're obviously, again, on the real estate asset management side, we've clearly acquired two businesses in Germany, so Insboden and Zeitgeist, which were out of insolvencies. And that requires some investment to build some of the capabilities which didn't exist in those businesses when we took on those people. So those are a couple of examples of that where we're not yet at scale. I think the other that's sort of the scaling of the platforms. I'd also point to, clearly, it's far more efficient when you have bigger funds, and therefore, the launch of ACO III will drive increased operational leverage when you're looking at the size of that fund as well. And then the second aspect around the profile of the fees on the lending. If you think about, we generally earn those servicing fees based upon primarily sort of three areas. One is upfront, second during the life, and then the third on the collections or realization of the investments. And typically, the first and third, so the upfront and the collection, are the lion's share of fees. And for most of our credit investments, you obviously have the upfront investment, but then you get realizations over the life of the investment because you typically that's the nature of the profile. Whereas for a lending product, it's because most of the loans are bullet repayments, you get the upfront fee, but you only get the back-end collection fee when that bullet repayment is made. And so that flows into the profile that effectively the servicing revenues for the lending products are slightly more back-end loaded. Hope that helps.
And in terms of the breakout between of the 11 million between those two categories?
It won't be far off half and half.
Understood. And just to be clear then on ALO, so they're roll-up and then bullet repayment, but do you not recognize the upfront fees when the loan is originated or over the life of the loan?
Yeah, we do. We do. But effectively, because ALO is in its effectively its first year, all of the volumes that are coming through, you're only getting really half of the more mature states, because you're getting half of the upfront fee. It's slightly different in terms of the you don't get half at the upfront and half at the back end. It tends to be slightly more back end loaded, but you're getting the upfront fee because the ALO has been going a year, but we're not yet recognizing any of those collection fees because it's in the first year of the fund. So once you get to a more mature state, that will then equalize, because you'll be having the maturing loans and the new loans, and therefore you'll be getting to a more consistent view. So I'd expect that over time, that investment drag of on the servicing fees for ALO to normalize and reduce out.
Okay, so some of those fees aren't recognized until you collect on the loan at repayment.
Correct, yes.
Understood. Okay.
Yeah, Carl, may also just be worth adding just one other point of detail, which is, as you know, our lending opportunity is a mix of bridge loans, some mortgage-type lending, and then some construction loans, where obviously on the construction loans, the NAV build is in line with the progress of the building. And so everything Phil says, obviously, this is right, but the other component of it is that the NAV and some of the asset management and fee base is kind of profiled in line with the actual drawdown profile, which is in line with the progress of the building. And so there just is a that also contributes to the lag component.
Understood. So the deployments number that you disclose, that is effectively the funded amounts on ALO, but
exactly.
But you'll have originations which are higher than that.
Correct. If we were to, that's exactly right. And if you were to, instead of reporting the deployed amount, which is what we've done, which is the funded amount, exactly as you said, if you were to report a number like total capital committed to investment, it'd be a much bigger number.
Understood. That's helpful. And then in terms of the Zenith sale, just strategically, you noted that it wasn't to a competitor. Can you just describe the profile of Zenith and why you saw it as non-core, or was it more a fact that it was kind of surplus capability versus what you had in Italy? And was there also an element of you just felt like it was a good return and provided liquidity for, as you look into next year and presumably further growth with ACO 3, was that also a part of the equation in terms of doing that deal?
Yeah, so appreciate the question. So Zenith's core business is basically acting as a trustee, monitoring agent, and master servicer for Italian securitizations. That was a really important platform to us 8 years ago when we first entered the Italian market, because when you sit as the trustee, you're in the flow business, right? You see all the deals come through the market. You can act in those monitoring agents and master servicing capacities, and that informs you as to how servicers perform, how assets perform, which originators are doing what, which servicers are doing what. It's a very helpful eyes on the market seat at the table. We benefited from that as we got to know the Italian market and get situated in understanding kind of where we wanted to play harder, and obviously have acted on those convictions with buying Europa Investimenti, buying Sansidoni, buying Sagita, and then picking up the Sistemia part of Ikira. At this stage, the significant both asset origination and asset servicing occurs in those four ladder platforms, which we own in different capacities. And obviously the Ikira one we own through the Ikira structure in the fund, but the other three we own outright in a permanent way. That's given us enough presence in Italy to satisfy our goals and our funds. I mean, that's a very strong market position in Italy, and Italy is now just one out of eight countries in our funds. And so I think, I mean, Zenith was an attractive platform. There wasn't anything that we didn't want to own about Zenith. It felt, I don't want to say surplus to requirements, because I think that's a bit strong, but it felt that we could live without it given the other four platforms we had. We then looked at how many deals Zenith directly originated for the funds, and the number was tiny. I mean, it did do a few, but very, very few. And therefore, when the opportunity existed to preserve the sourcing agreement and servicing agreements for 5 years, which really gives us all the continuity we need to manage those capabilities with our four existing platforms, were relevant, whilst being able to cash out over $110 million of value, that was an opportunistically attractive outcome. I mean, as Phil and I have said, whilst we would like to make more progress on deleveraging is our key focus, and so we're obviously trying to get the balance right between building the franchise, which I think you've seen we've done in a very strong way, whilst also effectively getting net debt down. And so being able to take $110 million at 14 times EBITDA off the table for a business that we bought for $23 million and took dividends out of over the last 8 years was opportunistically attractive to us given circumstances. So it was something that, I mean, I think Carl, you obviously have tracked us for a long time. You know us well. I mean, we are keen on building the strategic franchise, and that is a very key objective that underpins the value of the group. I think we were able to do this in a way that didn't compromise that at all and got 110 of cash back. That I think was the right thing to do for all stakeholders.
Understood. That's helpful. Thanks. Last question for me then, just around deployments. So you're at kind of 2.7 billion LTM. Is the expectation for full year 25 that you will be in and around that number? Or, you know, what is the kind of the full year 25 expectation at this point?
Do you want to take that, Phil, or do you want me to?
You can take it, yeah.
We don't usually give that specific guidance level, but we do need to see how the fourth quarter plays out. As you know, the fourth quarter incorporates many end-of-year sales, that some of which usually still arise between now and the end of the year. But yeah, we'll be thereabouts. I think that's a reasonable guess, and I think the risk is to the upside on that number.
Understood. Thank you.
We will now take our next question from Ryan Fluke from PVT Point. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks very much for taking the call. Three from me, but definitely big congratulations on such a good fundraising success. Just on that, can you remind us where ACO2 first closed, sort of what level that was, and so that we can compare it to where ACO3 is, or I guess put differently, are you able to kind of comment on final targets for ACO3, given the information you have now?
Yeah, so the honest truth is I don't remember where ACO2 first closed. It was well south of here. I mean, obviously, it was something in the mid-ones from memory. It was something in the... I don't hold me to this. It's something like 1.3 to 1.5 billion, something like that. We're obviously here. We're 2.7 on the first close, which so I mean we're substantially substantially progressed from ACO2's first close. In terms of how you read that across into final targets. Yeah, look, obviously, I mean, it's frustrating with these SEC rules as to what we're allowed to say and what we're not. We're targeting amounts, obviously, substantially higher than here. I think the documents allow us to fundraise for a further 18 months in total. We've achieved this in circa 6 months. I don't think I can give you the exact details of the fund, but it's substantially north of what this number we've printed as a first close. I don't expect us to take anything like 18 months to get to a final close. I guess I would say it's a franchise question. This is probably the best way to answer that. Is we look at the trailing origination that is particular to ACO, and we try and set the size of the fund equal to roughly 3 years of the trailing origination, right? Because the way you think about it is if it's a three-year investment period and you basically say, look, that's what I deployed last year. If I did the same thing again for the next 3 years, I would need this amount of capital. And hence, from the franchise, from the GP's perspective, that's a proportionate kind of equation that people can assess and get their head around. They just have to look at what we've done in the past, and if we keep doing it, then we'll deliver the fund model. And then from a cynical LP's perspective, what it basically says is, okay, you've expanded in Germany, France, Spain. You've obviously grown the wider franchise. All of that growth is a buffer in case times are harder. All you got to do is what you've done in the past, but we'll give you effectively credit for that on a trailing basis as opposed to a forward basis. And so that's how the calculus works. It gets you to a number substantially north of the 2.7, but it gives you a target. It's not that this isn't a question of, like, can you go out and raise the maximum amount you could possibly go gather. It's a measured event where you take what you did last year, you multiply it by three. That's kind of a broadly sensible target because it relies on trailing actuals, and then you go fundraise that amount, which is well north of 2.7. And then if people want to give you co-invest on top of that in case markets turn or you see bigger deals, then that co-invest is optional to use as opposed to mandatory. And so that's broadly how it's done. After final close, we'll give you exact figures and a far more detailed answer, but that's probably all we can say at this stage.
Got it. That's really helpful.
Sorry, I was just going to add, Ryan, the first close of ACO2 was just slightly north of $1 billion on the 2.75, so just shy of 40%. So the 2.7 is definitely ahead of that position.
Got it. That's super helpful. And then there's a couple more for me, if I may. Sort of more generally, as you talk about the franchise and just the very strong growth you guys have had in AUM, do you see yourselves sort of expanding into any other business verticals than the ones you already have?
So I'd say quite a bit to that question. So we obviously have the real estate lending business. We obviously have the credit opportunities business. And we have, as you see in the stats, a much smaller real estate equity business. We do work on certain thematic things on real estate equity, which aren't in fund form. As those mature, we would hope to raise commingled capital against them. But that's typically the development path, i.e. to keep your own CapEx and cost progressions kind of in line with franchise progress. If, for example, we own Details, the hotel operator in Portugal, we have done a lot of good work. Our funds manage Villa Mora, for example, and a whole series of other assets that the Details platform leads on. As those areas get greater and greater maturity, the case for raising commingled capital against different aspects like that is high. And they're several categories that have now done double-digit deals in the same sector, arising a track record and a proven capability that would be fundraisable in due course. There's a couple other pieces. I mean, if you look at what other asset managers do, it's quite obvious that we're quite limited in aperture versus some of them. And there are a couple of things that we'll probably announce in the course of 26 that we think are super exciting that we've been incubating to date. But again, let us do that properly once. Let me say it the other way. We will announce that when all of the following conditions are met, when we feel like we've got the track record and the investment capability to support the fund, and where we've already closed substantial LP commitments into the product. And so we're not going to announce kind of, hey, we have aspirations in category X or Y. When we do the announcement, you'll see that we've actually got the deal flow, have the investment capability, and have already closed on the investor commitments for that category. And so we would, having two multi-billion euro programs is a good foundation to expand from. As you see, our cross-sell rate at greater than 50% is already, I think, really attractive. We would love to make that three and have a clear plan in mind as to how to do that, but we'll announce it when that's when all those conditions are met, and it's a live product that investors have already supported, as opposed to something that's in pilot phase.
Got it. And then that's great. And then finally, from me, just as it relates to, I guess as you've said multiple times, it's now two products north of a billion, which is a long way from when your shareholders first got involved in this business. So it's just a substantially much larger Arrow Global is today than then. Can you guys comment on kind of any plans your shareholder has to seek a sales process?
We agree. Look, I think having grown from five countries to eight and one product and one fund to two multi-billion products and a third smaller product, and I think we now manage seven vehicles in total, it's been a substantial progress from when TDR bought us. I think, and if you look at the fund manager progress, I mean, go track that from 2021 to now, as I say, I think it's grown 430% in terms of the outturned period on period to where we expect to be next year. So look, we've made a lot of progress. I think equally net debt and leverage ratio is too high. I mean, we want to keep making progress. And so I think the shareholder calculus is allowing as much of that FRE income to build, and it's growing at a very fast rate. So allowing that to build, given it trades at a very high multiple, is shareholder accretive. And so I don't think we'll do anything in the immediate term, given the growth of that FRE and the positive trajectory there. But obviously they are a fund, and at some point an event will happen, but I don't think it's imminent.
Great. That's really helpful. Thanks.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1. We'll now take our next question from Alexander Kerfoot from Nordea. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks so much for taking my question. Going back to the AI wording that you had in your presentation, could you give a bit more color on the impact you see there from those developments, efficiency gains, etc., to your cost base, and how that might more than offset any wage inflation or FTE count development that you see? If you could give a bit of color on that looking forward, and maybe also if there's any one-offs we should be aware about in connection to such developments, and whether also you would capitalize on AI development, if there's any elevated CapEx to think about looking ahead. That would be my first question. And then maybe secondly, if I can, I think you worded at one point you see FUM of around 15 billion euros in the medium term, whether that means 2028 or 2030 or what have you, if you still see that, and if the added profitability you have on those new FUM coming in, if that's with the same profitability as your existing FUM base. Thank you.
Shall I take those? So on AI, I'll deal with it in various stages. So just to on the CapEx side first, we expect our capital expenditure to be broadly consistent with prior years. We're not expecting the AI to increase our CapEx to any great extent. And equally, we're not expecting any increase on the operational costs of the implementation of AI solutions. They will largely be consistent with our IT spend on an OpEx and CapEx side historically. On any one-off, that's a difficult one to answer. There clearly will be efficiency savings, and that can mean reduction in people, which clearly comes with an associated cost. We're not at that stage of giving any guidance or any plans around that. And then just in terms of the what do we see as the efficiency gains, I guess that comes into various different categories. And actually, when you look at the slide that we've shown, clearly there's a number of opportunities. The sourcing and in underwriting developments, so the origination sourcing capabilities enable us to probably expand the franchise more. As sort of Zach referenced, when you can trawl through multiple thousands of legal documents to source and scorecard that, then it probably enables you to just expand your funnel of opportunities rather than be a cost efficiency. The underwriting tool, I think, will help us make better underwriting decisions and will flow through to improved returns for our investors, which broadens the franchise. Obviously, on the servicing and operational efficiency, they tend to be more cost efficiencies, in particular in the servicing area. We're not giving any guidance on quantum of that at this stage. I think it's quite difficult. In some respects, I think there's various dynamics to that. Is one is how much cost can we take out? How much does just generally the market slightly reprice and how much gets passed on to third party customers. But what I will say is that we've got a number of trail wins, not just AI, but operational leverage, as I sort of discussed when we were answering Carl Guggenheim's question around the investment drag. We've got quite a few tailwinds, so I do expect our margins to increase as AI efficiencies are evolving and also we're getting increased operational leverage. Moving on to the FUM question. So yeah, we've got a 15 billion target. As you sort of see, we reported 13.6 billion at the end of September. And so you know, that's with 2.7 billion closed into the latest fund. We will be very, very close, I think, to that 15 billion target when we've closed ACO 3. And so that's we expect to hit that objective relatively soon. It won't be, it will be certainly before 28-30 time frame. I'd expect it to be within the, you know, round about the year.
Okay. Thanks. That's helpful. Maybe just a final one then, factoring in these things you just touched upon, do you still see sort of similar cash flow generation, cash flow burn next year, including funding costs?
No, I think there's two big dynamics. Well, three big dynamics that you should factor in. The first is the realizations profile. As I mentioned, the realizations for next year are based upon our current ERC, are some 70 million higher than the expectation for this full year. So that's the first. So that will be a significant impact. The second is the co-investment level. So broadly speaking, this financial year, we've been deploying capital largely from ACO2 and ALO, which are 10% and 7% co-investment respectively. Next year we will be deploying increasingly from ACO3 and the lending fund, where the co-investment levels are 6% and the 7%. So you should expect based upon similar levels of deployment, we'll obviously look to increase deployment as we expand the franchise, but given that the ACO2 going from and all of that volume going from 10% to 6% co-investment, I'd expect a lower co-investment next year. And then the third factor is the ongoing build of the capital light business, as we sort of say and have referenced. That's a function of the deployed NAV, the deployments, and that build of NAV. So, you know, we're seeing strong growth in our capital light earnings coming through on the discretionary side and the third party asset management side. So we'd expect those three factors to lead to a materially less capital burn next year. Oh, that's
okay,
helpful.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you.
As a reminder, to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1. And our next question is from Bruno Reed Cutton from ADF Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. I've got two questions. The first one is, could you just please let us know what your NAV is per fund? Be helpful. And then secondly, how should we expect ACO1, the profile of that, the realizations there next year, just to add, I guess, how much NAV will be depleting, because obviously we can model the ramp up, but it's just good to know how much NAV will be returning back to these next year. Thank you.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I mean, you'll see that the NAV is 4.6 billion. I don't have the figures off my top of my head, but ACO1 will be something like about a billion of that number. ACO2 will be round about 2.8-ish billion. So that's 3.9, and then the remainder is ALO. In terms of the collections profile, then effectively, obviously, ACO1 will continue to collect out. I think we don't give sort of specific guidance on you know the you know how much by each fund is collecting out, but you can sort of see the collections profile that we've had over the as Zach referenced earlier, around the 0.5 billion distributions over the period since it closed, and we'd expect something similar during the course of next year.
So that 0.5 billion is over the last 2 years since the investment period ended in November of 23. So if it were to be linear, it'd be in that kind of 250, 300 million a year range. Which again,
okay,
it's not linear, but I mean, if you want a directional number, that's not a bad directional number for a model.
Okay, understood. Okay, I wasn't sure if there'd be like a tail. So it'd actually be more lumpy in the first few years, and then sort of it is kind of quite proportionate annually. Then
it's closer to proportionate. I mean, it's a lot of assets. I mean, just to give you that's probably worth picking up conceptually. I mean, take ACO2 for example. It's 300 investments and 9,000 underlying assets, and so you're selling these things in a smoother way than you're envisioning. I mean, yes, there are a few lumpy things, but that's the exception. I mean, to put that perspective, ACO1's never had a collections quarter lower than 50 million. Every single quarter ACO1's ever had, the realizations are more than 50. So, just to give you a sense.
Okay, that's helpful. And then just for modeling purposes as well, when does ACO2... when does that actually stop investing? How long are reinvestments for, and when would you start to see that NAV, start to default?
Yep. So the investment period for ACO2 technically ends in April of 26. That's a reasonable guide as to when you'd start to see NAV stop growing and instead start to turn down. Start to move towards it. I mean, other than that one exceptional distribution we did because we collected a lot of money, we collected more than 300 million in a quarter and therefore distributed the surplus. Basically everything else we've been recycling, which is what we're supposed to do. And then starting in April 26, that flow reverses. And so from April 26 on, you'd expect to see realizations at ACO2 be distributed.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then just my final question. Do you envisage that there'll be any other non-core asset sales potentially, the only sort of assets in use in the business which you don't need to get a similar decent multiple for, or was that kind of a one-off?
Look, we'll keep reviewing that. You've seen us do it twice now. So we sold off CapQuest a couple years ago. We sold off Zenith this year. So it is something we keep reviewing. If we can get good prices for things and they don't contribute to our funds in a meaningful way, then there's no reason not to sell them. I think that's the right management action. Yes, it's something we'll keep reviewing. There's nothing else that's imminent.
Okay, understood. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. I will now take our next question from Felix Fischer from Lucror. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. My first question is a bit simplistic, possibly. You had a huge quarter in terms of asset management growth from 10.7 million to 13.6 billion, so congrats for that. Just taking a very simplistic view, and I know it's not completely linear, but this would actually suggest that your asset management income would grow by over 25% relatively quickly. Is that a too simplistic view? I know it's not completely linear, but can you comment a bit on that, please? That's my first question.
Yeah, sure. I'll say that. I mean, obviously, as I mentioned, we typically earn the majority of our income from deployed capital rather than committed capital. So obviously, the FUM growth that we've reported is because we've increased the level of commitments to our funds. So it's really the growth in our earnings is more a function of the deployment rather than the actual fundraise. And so happy to spend some time with you going through that. But essentially, the charts on that we show on slide nine and then in the appendix, which show the build of earnings more on deployment. I think the key thing, though, is effectively once you've got the commitments, then effectively you have the dry powder to be able to go and make those deployments. So in the example that I gave, the illustrative example around, if we continue to deploy $3 billion, then we grow our NAV to round about $8 billion. You'll see now, obviously, that the and you see this from slide nine, where we've got current NAV of $4.6 billion, and we've got dry powder of $4.2 billion. So effectively, what this capital raise that we're announcing today means is that we've got sufficient capital committed from LPs to be able to continue to deploy that $3 billion and level and grow to that NAV that we've talked about. So if you think about the stages of a fund management business as being sort of raising the funds from LPs and then investing it, which drives the revenue, we've kind of done half of that activity and de-risked that activity. We now just need to deploy it, and then that's when the earnings come through. Hopefully, that answers the question.
Yeah, that's very clear. So in a way, it's a bit delayed, but in principle, it will happen. Let's say it takes some time to be fully deployed, but in principle, this growth of 25% or so will happen over time. Yeah, so coming to you mentioned that sort of the performance-based fees, they are sort of back-ended towards the end of the funds. Can you share a bit when do you expect the first meaningful sort of performance-based fees to come in?
Yeah. So we've previously sort of guided, and there's no change to the guidance for around about 40 million euros for ACO I, and then a little over 100 million euros for ACO II in terms of performance fees. And we'd expect those to be recognized. ACO I will be back end of next year or into early 2027. And then ACO II will be something like 2029, 2030, that sort of time frame. It's clearly highly dependent upon the realizations profiles that we've just been talking about.
Okay. Thank you for that one. And now coming to net leverage, it's okay if you exclude the one-off, I would say, for the sale. Net leverage is at 6.0, according to my math, it's 6.2x, which is obviously substantially higher than your target range. And in Q3, 2024 was a huge quarter, and that fell out, obviously, where you had, yeah, very, very substantial collection performance. And you say collection performance can be very lumpy. Just can you remind us a bit, could something like Q3 2024 repeat, or what are the main drivers for this sometimes really very volatile collection performance? Is it a single assets that you realize, or is it a couple of assets? Just please remind us why Q3 24 was so exceptionally strong.
Yeah, so as I sort of referenced, you know, the realization profiles can be lumpy, given the realization is from the sale of the real estate, and so there were two portfolios, big portfolios, in Q3 2024, which realized. I think there will clearly be some trends going forward. And I reference that we're currently expecting realizations next year to be 70 million higher than the realizations in the total of for the total of this year. You won't see another event like Q3 2024, and the reason I say that is because now, as the back book decreases, we don't have those assets where that lumpy collection, 100% of it's coming to Arrow. Now that we are a co-invest, you get just a more natural smoothing of the of that lumpiness. We expected leverage to increase. And clearly, I guess the two factors that I talked about, where we are above where we expected to be at the time of the refinancing, the non-cash foreign exchange. I think everybody should be comfortable with that, given we're economically hedged on a go-forward basis. And then, you know, the increase because of increased deployments, clearly, that from a franchise perspective is very positive, that we're exceeding our targets that we set at the time of, or the trajectory of our targets that we set at the time of the refinancing. We're clearly taking action by reducing the level of our co-invest down to 6% to make sure that we're not seeing the same burn on cash as I just referred to on a go-forward basis. So we're sort of committed to deleveraging. We're very strong on our discipline around capital, and that's hence why we've announced the sale and transacted the sale of the non-core platform of Zenith. But I think when you step back and just think about, do we have a sustainable path to deleveraging? Because this is the important thing, is that our balance sheet's risen a little bit in size, but we don't expect that to be permanent because of the reduction in co-invest. And so as we go forward and that 6% co-invest starts to feed through, you should see the balance sheet reduce, and that will feed through into deleveraging. But the sustainability of the deleveraging comes from the ongoing and increase in capital light revenue streams. As we just referred to, it's just a matter of now we've raised that capital, it is just a case of the maths playing through if you continue to deploy at these sorts of levels, and then performance fees on top come in. So we're very comfortable that we have the right commitment to deleveraging and the right pathway to deleveraging, even though we've we've seen the spike at this quarter, largely as expected, but slightly higher from those two reasons. But we remain committed to deleveraging, and we think we've got a clear pathway and a business model which achieves it.
Thank you very much. These were very clear, helpful answers. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It appears there are currently no further questions at this time. With this, I'd like to hand the call back over to Zach to close the call. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergey. Well, look, we appreciate the engagement today. Thank you for going through the nine-month results with us. If we look forward to doing the full-year results early in 26. And thank you for your time today, and talk to you in early next year. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect.